Yes, hello, folks. Welcome to a very special episode of the Manchester United podcast. We are United Podcast. I am delighted to be joined with a gentleman who most Manchester United fans will be aware of. Nur Eddin, of course. I've known him as Bearded Genius from our digital relationship. Goes back a long time from the Red Tree Sanctuary. Someone that I found both extremely interesting, politically sound, funny, very talented, who covers a lot of different things, a lot of, in life, whether it's sport, whether it's politics. And I'm here to talk to him about his fantastic book, Inshallah United. I haven't had a chance to read it all the way through, but what I have read of it so far and the reviews that I've read of it so far, it's fantastic. It's brilliant. Highly recommend it. I'll post links to where you can get the book at the end of it. So first of all, Nur Eddin, how are you doing, mate?
Yeah, I'm doing good. How are you?
All good, mate. All good. It seems like I've known you digitally for must be 20, close to 20 years. We've changed a lot in that time. Red Issue Sanctuary was a brutal forum. Didn't suffer fools gladly, but it was a brilliant community. Are you still part of it?
No, I'm not. But I think you're completely right. I think it's. I think when you kind of make your way on social media and then you gain you gain a bit of notoriety on social media, it's very easy to get a bit of an ego about it and to think you think you're something special. And I think in terms of a bit of a finishing school to knock yourself down a bit in terms of your ego, I think the Sank was good in that respect, because like you say, they. If anyone got a bit up themselves, they weren't having it, and it kept you humble and it kept you honest. So
That's a microcosm of British culture in general. That if you ever get too above yourself, you know, you'll get brought back down to earth. You'll be reminded you didn't have an arse in your trousers when they first met you. You know,
do you find that's different in the States?
Yes, very different.
And over here, is it? Yeah.
So one of the reasons why it's very different here, in the UK, there's most people are very similar socioeconomic status. There's very little variance between people. You know, most people in a classroom are going to be of a similar, you know, background in terms of, you know, the privilege and status that you have, how much money you make. But here, the variance can be broad. You know, you could have a kid in the classroom where their parents are making 50 grand a year and another kid making 5 million a year. So there's really no symmetry between the working class experience. It's just so broad. So, you know, whereas back home, you know, you come from these small, you know, enclave neighborhoods where no one was growing up in a $5 million mansion, you know, but that can happen here.
Right.
So, you know, you're always reminded of your propinquity to the working class and that you're never above that. But here, you know, and I don't think that's healthy here because, you know, it inevitably leads to values being placed on humans based on their income and job status. And you're starting to see that, unfortunately, back home. But yes, it's very different here. But I want to talk to you about your book, Made in Salah United. Tell me a little bit about that. I want you to tell me about yourself, your background, and what was the inspiration behind this book?
To be perfectly honest, I needed a bit of convincing to write the book in the first place, because the publishers approached me and kind of broached the possibility of writing a book. And obviously, the first thing that goes through your head when someone suggests that is again, talking about ego, like your ego kicks in and you kind of think, oh, wouldn't it be great to write a book? You're very flattered. But then, certainly for me, I didn't want to do something or enter into something that I didn't feel sure about. Because, and again, like the thing with writing a book is it's such a big undertaking. And I was doing it outside of my day job. So it basically meant not having much of a life while I was doing it. So I didn't want to do something that I wasn't proud of. And you'll know as well as me that there's a million books out there about United. So, and especially the Fergie era. So then I was thinking, what is the point of yet another book? What is the point of yet another book about that time and that place? and growing up in that era, that's not already been said. So I kind of said no at first, but then speaking to the publishers, we kind of got to the point where they said, well, it's less about what happened, and it's more about how you experienced what happened. And it's kind of what you were pointing to. We had a brief chat before we started recording, and it's that thing of I knew that if I could get into the mind frame of being a kid and how that felt, then at least I'd be able to give a unique perspective. And yeah. also like I suppose I had that experience of being like a second generation Pakistani kid. Both parents came from Pakistan. English was not their first language. They had to start from scratch here. We had no family, and also the thing about being a Muslim and being working class, and I think what that does, you'll have experienced this as well with your heritage and sort of where you've traveled to different places and settled in different places. If you're not automatically part of somewhere, then there's a part of you that really mm-hmm. wants to be part of that and fit in. And especially as a kid, you desperately want to feel a part of things, knowing that you're different and sort of constantly being reminded that you're different. So that's where something like football is such an amazing thing. It's that thing of like, it feels like such an irrelevant thing, like it's just a sport. Why should we care this much? Why should you and I as grown-up adults mm-hmm. care so much about these millionaires, multimillionaires who don't know who we are? But it's that thing of it's not about that. It's about feeling part of something and feeling connected. And as soon as I latched onto football and got into football, like I felt part of something. I felt part of and again, like it's so wanky in this day and age. Like, you know, the sort of the whole thing on Twitter and social media where it's all like MUSC family and it's all so lame mm-hmm. and sort of superficial, but like it genuinely felt as if you were part of something and almost part of a family as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting points there. You know, one of the things that when you have a different identity and you want to be accepted, it's a bit complex because you're constantly told you need to assimilate, but you're reminded every day that you're not the same. And so it's very difficult to find a space where, you know, you retain your identity, but you're also accepted because your identity is very important to you. And, you know, you're writing a book from your own perspective, but it's a perspective shared by many that transcends identity. I mean, some of the language that you've used in here is exactly how I would describe the same experience through my eyes as a child, whether we have similar backgrounds or not. But I also think it is important, Nordine, for Muslim kids, you know, who probably in this day and age face more, you know, prejudice and discrimination than probably most other people, and are that they too, you know, have people exactly like them that write people that write books like this from their perspective that says you are as much a part of this as anyone else, and that your identity is not pejorative, it's perfectly fine, and that this is really, really important. As a kid coming from Belfast over to England to watch United, I was really concerned because I was worried about what was I going to experience. You know, were English people going to hate me? And I was worried about that. And one of the things that's attracted me to United was that the United fans always seem to have a sense of social justice, of inclusivity, that I never experienced any, you know, insult or anything that made me feel unwelcome or that my identity was something that I needed to be ashamed of or embarrassed about or to pretend that I wasn't. And, you know, there are certain clubs that don't have that. Did you experience that as a United fan, where you always felt that your identity was not relevant to how you were accepted?
Completely. That's exactly how I felt. And the funny thing is that because growing up when I did and having the parents that I did, my parents, obviously, when the first generation comes over from another country, like in my case, both parents came over from Pakistan, they mm-hmm. had to face the National Front. Dead Space, the BMP, and they, I think what that does to you psychologically is it makes you almost live within yourself. So you never want to stand out. Yeah. You never want to garner any attention, and you almost get into this mind frame of like, keep your head down. Like, if no one pays attention, that's good, because that means no one's gonna attack you. No one's gonna paint horrible things on your house. No one's gonna shout abuse at you for wearing a headscarf or whatever, or having a beard. So that's the mind frame they had. And as second generation immigrants, you take a bit of that on board, but then you kind of do want to stand out, and you do want to make your mark, and you've got that extra little bit of confidence of like, I do belong here to a certain extent. And whereas from my parents, it was a case of they were Pakistani and they'd come over to Manchester. For me, it was, I had Pakistani heritage and I was proud of that Pakistani heritage, but I was Mancunian. I was born in Manchester. I'm Mancunian. And like, I grew up with that sense. And going to games, it was a bit of a struggle to get to go, because my parents weren't into football, so they didn't quite understand why I was so obsessed. But also, in terms of going to games and getting permission to go to games, and that would only happen if somebody's dad was going, or somebody's parents could take me with another kid. It was a case of they were still nervous because they'd grown up, or they'd sort of like got used to a situation where if there's any situation where it's a majority white sort of crowd, and you are in a very small minority of brown people, their experiences told them that that's dangerous.
Yes, of course.
So they were very nervous about me going to football games. And also, the thing is, no one lives in a vacuum. So the whole horrendous sort of propaganda that, like, the Thatcher government and the right-wing papers, like, essentially painted football fans as animals. Mm-hmm. And hooligans and a lot of that sort of spilt into the rhetoric around Hillsborough where the fans were blamed because fans were seen as subhuman.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents like they sort of consumed that sort of message. So that almost sort of fed into their sort of like fear of like me going to games, because they'd heard was like football hooligans. Always causing trouble. But going to actual games, my experience, like you say, was completely different. It was almost this sense of, if you're a red, you're one of us. It does not matter. It does not matter. Your accent doesn't matter. Your skin color doesn't matter. It doesn't matter where you're from. Like, if you're a red, you're a red. And it kind of feels utopian to sort of describe it in those terms when you know that sort of football bleeds into real life and real life bleeds into football. So as many dickheads as you'll have in society, you'll have at games and vice versa. But there was this sense of, you are one of us, and that was so powerful to me, and I felt accepted in a way that I didn't anywhere else. And it's like, I suppose like, even with you, like immediately when you opened your mouth, people would have known where you're from.
Yes.
And also the thing with sort of anti-Irish prejudice and racism is, and xenophobia, is that I think people forget how recent it was. I think people just assume now that Irish people are just accepted and part of society and they don't have a problem in England. Whereas it was definitely in my lifetime where Irish people were horrible sort of like assumptions about sort of anytime there was any sort of similar to sort of my experience sort of now and later on about anytime there's a terrorist sort of attack, is it Muslims? Like not long ago, it's like anyone with an Irish accent would be blamed.
No, listen, when I would go through airports, Heathrow, whatever, London, about, you know, being a young, you know, 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old, you know, when you heard about the, you know, the random screening, right, which clearly was not random. I mean, I remember going through this, having, you know, carry on gifts being broken, being smashed and stuff, and having all sorts of insults leveled at me. But, you know, I think that there's a certain segment of any country that has that. One of the things that was really interesting for me in this whole experience was the segregation that I was experiencing in Belfast, religious and nationalistic segregation, stopped the minute I got on the bus to go to United. It was weird because I hadn't experienced this many times. The segregation of you're Catholic, you're Protestant, you're a nationalist, you're a unionist, stopped the minute we got on the coach to go to Old Trafford. That is where the assimilation happened, where it didn't matter what you were, a Catholic, Protestant, we were all United fans. And in many ways, especially, you know, it's different now because your social and political influences are on the internet. But when you're growing up, when we were growing up pre-internet, your social political views are shaped by the influences around you, your parents, your culture, your experience, your community. So in many ways, these inclusive environments that United offered went a long way to changing my perspective of other people. That was no question, as a consequence of the environment that I was growing up in, we would have been biased and prejudiced. Then all of a sudden, you see people instead of reading about people, instead of hearing about people, and your lived experience is totally different. And that went a long way to changing my views, to being, okay, you know what, these people I've been told are monsters are not monsters. They're exactly like me. And in a small place like Belfast, I wasn't getting that experience. I had to go to somewhere like Manchester United fans, where, you know, masses, you know, community, diaspora all over the world. But going to Manchester, where there was no segregation, there was no division of identity. It was just like you said, we're all United fans.
No, that's exactly it, and it's that. It's that sense of, and again, like, it's the history of Manchester United. I know we can look at it from with like rose tinted glasses, and I mean, Lord knows, like if you, funnily enough, like it wasn't until the internet and social media that I kind of realised that not all United fans were sort of socialist and sort of like flying both kinds of red flag. I realised there was racist United fans, there was a right-wing United fans, and that was a bit of a shock in its own. But I think the reason why the match experience and the general sense around United fandom was so inclusive, it has a lot to do with how it's a global club, and in terms of fan base, and a lot of that goes back all the way back to the Busby Babes, the Munich tragedy, and the way that galvanized people around the world to sort of have an affinity with this club that was in a lot of senses was just another, back then it was just another club that was in the northwest of England. But things like being the first English club to win the European Cup, the story of Matt Busby building a team and then building a team again, it all sort of built into this mythology that made it a global club. And what that means, and like you say, it's that thing of, if you go to games, you are going to see people from everywhere, you're going to see people from all around the world. And in a way, it's quite humbling. I think especially on social media, and especially people who kind of support United online rather than sort of at games, they can almost be quite disparaging of like foreign fans, and almost as if they're lesser fans, whereas like in a lot of senses they're bigger fans, because they make more sacrifices. They'll wake up at like obscene hours to watch United, and that makes them more passionate in my eyes. So you definitely saw that at games, like you say, and it's funnily enough, like, it feeds into part of what motivated me to write the book, because, like you say, if you'd have stayed in Belfast, your sort of outlook of the world would be different. Yes. It doesn't matter how good a person you are. It doesn't matter how open your heart is. You are still sort of built from your experiences, and you would have a very sort of, well, a relatively more myopic view of the world. And so in writing this book, there was kind of two things that I hoped would happen. One was that like a Muslim kid, or like the version of me as a kid now, would sort of see a book written by a Muslim, and it's proudly called Inshallah United. There's like a Muslim word in the title, and that would sort of inspire them to sort of like think, well, why can't I write a book? Why can't I do something? Why can't I sort of achieve something like that? So that was one of the intentions. And the other intention, which is just important for me, is that if you look at Brexit, or if you look at any sort of polling, or you look at any sort of opinions that are sort of collected about refugees and or Muslims or anything, where you'll get the most prejudice are the people who haven't come in contact with them. It's like what you were saying. So in a way, you can't fully blame those people for thinking the way they do, because all they know about Muslims, all they know about refugees, all they know about these different kinds of people, the people that they see different to them, is what they read, what they see in the news, what the Daily Mail says on the front cover, what the Daily Telegraph says. So what I was hoping is that like some of these people who have never met a Muslim sort of would pick up this book as a book about football, and then it would almost sort of like, it would almost be like a stealth education to them in terms of like, I'm writing the book about United, but from the point of view of a Muslim kid. And what I'd hope is that, like, if they've never met a Muslim and then they read the book, it sort of, even in a small way, makes them think, actually, I'm not that different from this
100%.
This guy.
So, because I think one of the things you also have to do, Nordin, is for young Muslim kids to not think, you know, I have to, raise my identity to be accepted as a United fan. So instead of that, I could say, you know what, I'm a proud Muslim, and it's completely compatible with being a Manchester United fan. You don't have to pretend, you know, that I'm a secular Muslim, or that, you know, this is that I have to, you know, suppress my identity for fear, you know, of delegitimizing myself for saying that it's not commensurate with being a Manchester United fan. You know, there's plenty of books on Irish Reds. There's plenty of books on other identities that, you know, are completely compatible with Manchester United. And I think if you're a young Muslim kid, you know, I mean, you'd be thinking, for me to be accepted in this community, you know, I have to suppress this identity. And, you know, I think that's really, really important. Representation matters. Perspective matters. And there isn't many books out there that's written from that perspective. It's also good for non-Muslims to read this and say, how do these kids see the world? You know, how does it appear to them? You know, what are the intersectional things that they're dealing with on a daily basis, so I can understand the world from that perspective better rather than judging? I think a lot of prejudice comes from, you know, I think prejudicial views are doing some emotional heavy lifting, because there's certain fears about people, there's, you know, certain insecurities about themselves, that it's easy to project that pain and that anger onto someone else and say, you're the reason why. And human beings have been doing this forever, but it has devastating consequences to people, even, you know, in their lived experience every day, be it here, be it somewhere else, and how they're dehumanized in the world. Let me ask you this. First generation immigrants of this era, did they want you to be a football fan? Was it difficult? Did your mom and dad, you know, try to discourage you? Did they have... Because parents, whether they're Muslim, Catholic, Protestant, doesn't matter, were very idealistic from this era. They had a very narrow-minded view of what they wanted their kids to be. I mean, even my parents were like, I wish you would drop this obsession and put that energy into your schoolwork, or do this, be a doctor, be this. Did you face difficulty or some resistance from your parents about being an obsessed native fan?
Yeah, I mean, I did. It's funny though, because it was slightly different in terms of how my mum dealt with it and how my dad dealt with it. Because, I mean, part of it was economic as well, because
sure.
we didn't have much money. We were absolutely sort of like working class in terms of the way we lived, but also like almost like below working class in terms of like we had no in terms of money we had none. We started from nothing. Like we had no family or no safety net. So if my dad's shop didn't do well one week, like we were in trouble. And
your dad had a shop. So tell me a little bit about that. Sorry, quickly.
So my dad, when my dad came over from Pakistan, he had various jobs. Like he worked in a plastics factory. He worked on buses and various other things. But then he managed to open his own hi-fi shop. So it was like it's like TV speakers and things like that. So he started that, and it was in a precinct, and we lived like above a shop within the precinct. So it was that sort of set out. But like where we lived, really, it shouldn't have been. It wasn't really meant for people to live in. It was actually, I think, office space that we kind of like made into a home. So like the roof was always leaking. The landlord wasn't really interested sort of in terms of like making it hospitable for sort of people to live. It was always meant to be an office. So like we'd have like silverfish sort of always sort of like scurrying about the floor, and we'd have damp everywhere. And part of what that meant is that we ended up growing up with asthma like as kids, because like it wasn't a great sort of environment health wise to live in. But the thing with football is even in a very kind of rudimentary way, I'm not even talking about going to games or buying tickets for that. Like even things like spending money on sort of football boots or a kit, which felt like a lot of money back then, or even weekly football magazines. Like that was money out of the family pot that we didn't really have for disposable things. So even that, like, it was a bit of a struggle, because it was like, okay, well, if you're interested in something worthwhile, if it's going to help your education, if it's going to help you sort of progress and have a career, then fine. But we can't afford to sort of fund this hobby. And why is this hobby becoming so big in your life? Why are you becoming obsessed with it? And I completely understand that feeling they had. But like with my dad was very much like a strict kind of father figure who sort of basically what he said when, like, he was quite old fashioned like that. And there was always a barrier between him and I in terms of like getting to know each other. And I talk about that in the book towards the end, where I kind of say, like, if he'd only lived a few more years, I kind of feel as if like I could have got to know him, and we could have got somewhere closer to being friends. But like that wasn't to be. But my mum, like, she was softer. She sort of like she wanted me to be happy. So like she would scrimp and she was like save up what she could and then get me what she could, and like even managed to get me like a football top that we really could not afford. And it's stuff like that sort of, it just made me. It made me so grateful then, but like looking back, it makes me even more grateful, because like she was really like she didn't have a job. She was just she was looking after the five of us in not great conditions, and she somehow like let me sort of enjoy this passion that I had. So it's something I'll always be grateful for.
It's funny because, you know, if you look at football, sport in general, from, you know, a macro perspective, you stand back, it makes no sense, you know. But this is true of art. You know, you go see the Mona Lisa, you could describe it as brush strokes, but yet there's something about that that makes you feel a certain way than the abstract that you can't explain, right? That logically it makes no sense. Same with music, it provokes emotions in you. If you can hear a song today that you heard 30 years ago, it reignites all these old feelings that you felt back then when you were listening to that song as a teenager in your bedroom. And, you know, I mean, we can watch clips of old football games and it will immediately teleport you back emotionally to where you were and how you felt when you watched. No matter how many times you've watched them, I mean, I'll still watch 1980s clips and I'm trying brought me back to a time when life was simplistic, when I wasn't ruining moments of extreme pleasure by reminding myself I've got things I shouldn't, I need to be depressed about. That don't you dare enjoy this present moment, because there's so much other negative shit in your life. You don't do that as a kid. You live in the moment. When we get older, we write promissory notes to ourselves to be happy. We'll be happy tomorrow. We'll be happy tomorrow. We never pay, right? It never comes, because we're constantly putting it off because there's always something to be depressed about. But football for me, and I'm going to ask you this, was a refuge for me from the poverty I was growing up in, which would be described as a similar experience. You know, we had no, you know, I was running about secondhand football boots, you know, secondhand bikes for Christmas and stuff. Well, we had nothing. I mean, pretty much no indulgence whatsoever. You know, when you get older, you become, you look back on that, you realize, like, you know, my mom and dad were doing everything they could. It just wasn't, you know, the alternatives. It wasn't due to lack of work ethic or anything else. It was just this, what was going on. But that brought me enormous embarrassment as a child, you know, where I felt like I wasn't as good as some of the kids that had nicer shoes, nicer clothes, that I had imposter syndrome, that I was always going to feel, you know, that I was, you know, I had a negative self-image. But football, Manchester United was a refuge from that, because that was the one time where I wasn't really negatively comparing myself, where I could just completely enjoy what was in front of me. Was it similar for you in the sense that football and Manchester United took you out of your current situation?
Absolutely, and it's that sense of, because this is why anything like that, like football, like music, any kind of expression or passion, that's why it's so important, and especially if it's especially so important if you've not got much, or your mm-hmm. or your life circumstances are not great, because it's almost like a life raft in your sort of in your existence. It's this thing of, like, when you're a kid, things, like you say, things are simple, and you kind of take pleasure in what you take pleasure in, and you don't question it. And then when you get older, you realize life is complicated, mm-hmm. and some people experience loss. Yes. Some people experience really negative relationships where they're abused. Some people experience addiction. Some people experience depression. There's all sorts of difficulties that everyone's going through in their own way, and you almost feel guilty for caring about something like football or sort of mm-hmm. getting lost in football. Yeah. But I think you almost make it full circle, where you kind of realize that if you are experiencing depression, if you are experiencing addiction, even if you're experiencing a family member going through addiction of some mm-hmm. sort, which is just as heartbreaking, if not more, mm-hmm. in some situations, you realize that life without those happy moments, life without those temporary sort of moments of joy, moments of excitement, moments of escape. Like, what would life be if you didn't have those things?
Yeah.
It's almost like if you can snatch as much happiness and feeling worthwhile and feeling part of something as you can out of life, then that's that. Like, your life is all the better for it. And it's that thing that your day can be shit. Your day can be sort of heartbreaking, but if you can escape into a football game, mm-hmm. you can feel like a winner. You can feel as if you're part of that team scoring a goal. And the same way, that's why people get lost in music. They can be having a really terrible time, and things can be devastating. Devastating things happen in their lives, and then they can just put the headphones on and listen to a bit of The Clash or David Bowie or whoever or Oasis. And for those 3.5 minutes, they feel as if they're in that band. They feel as if they're unbeatable. And it's those things that I think once you really think about it, and you think about life and what's important, you realize that what is important is love, and loving, whether it's loving your child or loving your family or loving your friends or loving football or loving music. Mm-hmm. If you can take as many of those moments out of life, then those little moments can add up, and then that means that that at least that part of your life was good.
Yeah, so these are the things that money can't buy.
Yeah. Right?
You can't buy a love for Manchester United. You can't buy a love for anything. Even when I'm coaching young kids, I tell parents all the time, you can't make somebody love something. If the kid wants to do it, they're not going to tell me, they're going to show me. If you want them to do it, forget about it. Okay. And I tell my kids the same advice. I'm like, I don't care what you do. If you want to paint pictures by the beach all day as a job and it makes you happy, fucking do that. But do not chase utility, do not chase money, do not chase job status, none of that, because it's a bottomless pit. Life to me is like a dance, right? You know, the purpose is not to get somewhere or to do it quickly. It's to enjoy every step of the way. So it's, you know, there's no destination, there's nowhere you're going, you know, and there's no check that somebody can write you that's going to emancipate you from the vicissitudes of life. You're going to have ups, you're going to have downs. Your human brain's hardwired to worry, but and I'm a recovering addict, one of the things that I learned in my addiction was the difference between happiness and pleasure. When I was taking drugs, I was chasing a temporary dopamine rush of pleasure, which is totally different to happiness. Happiness is finding spiritual, emotional nourishment in the things that you do every day. You know, you're not just going to work because you get a check at the end of it so you can pay bills. Because when you do that, you constantly do the bare minimum just not to get sacked, right? When you do something that you love, okay, this is the difference between rowing and sailing. When you row, you know, you're doing something that you hate, you get tired, you get stranded, you get fatigued, you get burnt out, and you have to keep rowing or you're going to drown. When you sail, when you do something that you love, your wind's always at your back, you go wherever you go, you know, you get up every day, you want to do what you're doing. And the last thing you're thinking about is the recompense, how much I'm getting paid, because the emotional satisfaction you get from doing what you love is worth billions. Right. And I speak to people that have a lot of money that are in turn going to be miserable because they have, you know, this money is like, money is the menu, right? The food, the menu and the food are totally different. So the menu is, you know, it's arid. It has no taste. It has no color. It has no value. It has, but the food is where the value is. And so to me, I think people that, you know, place value on human beings based on their ability to consume, you know, we're making a major mistake. And this is why we see homeless people, immigrants, you know, people that are illegal immigrants that have no political capital, that, you know, they're treated abhorrently because they have no capital and they have no money.
That's absolutely it. We've not spent very much time talking to each other, but like we do feel as if we've known each other for years, yeah. In a funny sort of way. And like, I know you well enough that you don't think in terms of like kids or family members, you don't think in terms of like are they going to make as much money as possible? Are they going to be as successful as possible in sort of a monetary sense? It's like, are they happy? Are they going to be happy?
Only thing I care about.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I care about. I don't, my, just do something that's not hurting another human being, right? And what I do raise my kids is to understand different cultures, to be curious about other cultures, to learn from people, to, you know, never assume a position of superiority because of any identity inferred on you, whether it's your gender, your nationality, your skin color, anything. None of these things you're in control of, okay? And there's nothing superior about you that another human being doesn't have. Please, you know, one of the things that I love about LA is that I am surrounded by different cultures, right? And you can use that as a tool of division, or you can embrace it. And what I've learned from other cultures is enriched me immensely as a person and helped me overcome some of my subconscious prejudices. So anyway, I'm still fucked up in a lot of ways, but I don't want to be someone that is certain in my hate, because I've been extremely depressed in life, and I can't invest emotionally in inflicting pain on someone else, because I just I don't know. But this is one of the things that your book is really, really important about, because we are constantly living in an era where culture wars are manufactured and weaponized against people. And one of the biggest targets of this, of course, as we've seen recent times, is the Muslim community. And feels like there's always something for the Muslim community that they have to apologize for, that they have to, you know, modify their behavior, or, you know, they're being judged by the fringes. And it's again, you know, this is also creating cultural divisions, because if you're on the receiving end of that hate, it's very easy to say, then I hate you too, and then become entrenched in your views and legitimize retaliation, because that's what happens in a radicalized society. And I grew up with this. Are you concerned about that and how it's being rekindled in society, and how that for young United fans, because, you know, the cultural differences and influences on people now are very different than before. Are you concerned about where that could, if that could change United's fan base, and how it could affect inclusivity, or do you feel that you know, it's overblown?
I mean, it's obviously a very clear concern sort of now, and has been for the last 15, 20 years, in terms of how Muslims are perceived and how Muslims are treated. It feels like it's getting worse. It's funny, because I think up until the 90s, I think there's a general sense that over time things will get better, like in terms of people would slowly become more accepting. Like, there was a sense that perhaps in the 60s and 70s, there was a way of life and it didn't include minorities, and even things like sexual preference, it was all hidden. So people were sort of very used to a very homogenous sort of ideal and expectation. Mm-hmm. But then, as people got more used to different people, interacted with different people, things would get better for Black people, things would get better for Muslim people, Jewish people, all sorts of minorities. Things would get better for people in the LGBTQ plus sort of community, and people would get more understanding. And it felt as if that's the way we were going up until the 90s. And then you realize that it's not a straight line. It's not a straight line that goes up and people become more accepting of people and more understanding. If you just take a wider view, you realize that that straight line is actually a line that goes up and down. So what you'll get is you'll get a time of like where fascism is at the ascendancy, and it becomes crucial for people to fight that that fascist element and that right wing element and that hate and that hateful element, both on a macro and micro level. And then you tend to find that sort of there's a backlash against that, and then people try hard to become more understanding and more progressive. But then slowly, if it's not checked and you don't pay attention and you don't do things to stop it, slowly the fear starts to rise, the anger starts to rise, and minorities, sometimes it's a different minority, start to become the victims of prejudice. And then suddenly the right wing rise up and fascism starts again. So it's cyclical rather than a straight line. So obviously at the moment, Muslims are treated abominably. But like, that's, I always try and look at the positives. And I think as humans, like, I think it's healthy to look at things wherever you can find the positive, try and find the positive. So for instance, like, I've been very vocal about what's like the genocide that's happening in Palestine at the moment, and the horror that Gazan people are experiencing. But then, where I can, I try and look at sort of the positives, and the positives I see is, although governments and world leaders might be sort of staunchly sort of denying the fact that there's a genocide happening, normal people care. Normal people. There's been an uprising, and there's been a swell of sort of humanity amongst normal people in a way that I've never seen before about that particular sort of issue, where they kind of say this is wrong, and in terms of looking positive, like I will even wherever possible, I always try and share situations where Israelis are sort of protesting against the war, and even if it's like a small group of people, because of they've got like a they're trying to sort of dampen any sort of opposition to the war, like they are still willing to fight. You're still getting conscientious objectors, like teenagers who have got no sort of power in their world. They are conscientiously objecting to going to war and being conscripted, and that's sort of the little moments of beauty and the little moments of hope that you kind of search for. And even in a football sense, this is why I love Cantona, because you talk about Muslims, and as Muslims, we kind of like always try and right the wrongs. We always try and sort of stick up for ourselves and try and explain that our religion is not one of hate, and we just want to live peacefully as everyone else. But then when you get someone like Eric Cantona, who has got no skin in the game really, and he has been so vocal about how Muslims are treated and how they're depicted, and he's done it at the most unfashionable times. Like there's a quote that I use in the book where he kind of it kind of really resonated with my feelings about the situation, where he said, what does moderate Muslim mean? Like, what does that phrase mean? It's what he called it was a latent provocation, which it is. He's basically saying, and I completely agree, if you're saying that someone is okay because they're a moderate Muslim, then what you're saying is they are Muslim, but not too much. So therefore, being Muslim is bad, and being any more Muslim than that is bad, and being a full Muslim is unacceptable. So that's why it's a provocation, and that's because I'm fully Muslim. Like I am proud to be Muslim, and like the fact that I've got a book out called Inshallah United sort of is testament to that. Like I'm so proud to be Muslim. It sort of it feeds into every part of my life. It kind of it really gives me a sense of how I should treat other people, and how I should be good and be kind to people, and it sort of affects every decision I make. And I'm not ashamed of that, because I see it as a really positive thing in my life, and I think that's what I really appreciated about someone like Cantona coming out and saying it, where it was a case of being fully Muslim, being totally Muslim. It's a beautiful thing. Like it's in the same way being fully Jewish or being fully Catholic or being fully humanist or having no affiliation to an organized religion is beautiful, as long as you are a good person.
I completely agree with this, and I'm an atheist, but my view on this, and I've said this to my kid, is I'm confident but not certain about anything. Okay, so I have a particular view, but it gives me no superiority over anyone. It does not make me, more intellectual than anyone. It doesn't make me better than anyone. And do I believe that if all religion ended tomorrow, we'd be living in a kumbaya world where we would not be executing each other? No. Human beings would invent other stories to do this. This is not a consequence of religion. This is a consequence of the human. Right, bottom line. So to me, again, we judge things from the fringes. There is communities all over the world that don't get heard. We have a community here. We have an imam and a rabbi here from the mosque and from the synagogue that do community work every single week together, right? And there's stories like this that goes on everywhere. There's tremendous work goes on in religious communities of people doing tremendous sacrifices, Catholic, Protestant, Jewish people. Doesn't matter. These are people with good hearts. They don't understand that at its core, religion is saying the same thing, right? That there's about loving each other, about accepting each other, about... And to me, every view that I have is derivative of the fact that every human life is equal. I don't care what your nationality is, what your identity is. We all feel to see him. We hurt to see him. We cry to see him. We love our kids to see him. We have the same instinct to protect our families. And we're all entitled to the same inalienable rights. Once we start inferring there's a value placed on a human being based on certain identities, then we're not a million miles away from the ideology that permits your slaughter based on your identity. And that has been used to justify the most abhorrent or abhorrent apex of human cruelty throughout human history. And the only thing that changes is the protagonist and the victim, right? That's it. And those that say, I'm a good guy, but I can permit this once, there's no such place. Right, because once we play an equivalent standard to all human beings, it's not permissible anywhere for exactly the same reason that the people who were murdered on October the 7th is a crime against humanity. Right, because these are innocent human beings like you, like me, that want the same thing, that want a little bit of peace, a little bit of prosperity, the right to raise their kids in an environment where they can thrive, a little bit of comfort, and then we dignity and die. That's it. Right, and I think every human being should be entitled to that. Right, and there's nobody should be allowed to take that from someone. So to me, we have a little bit of that. I get back to what we're saying in the Manchester United community, where those identifiers disappear, and we unify under one community. I'll talk to you a little bit about a couple of chapters, and don't take too much more of your time. But one of the things that I found really, really fascinating was your complex view of United Legends and how zero sum we can be. You can be a legend and then go play for Manchester City, and all of a sudden it dissolves everything that you did, that you've done. You wrote stuff about Schmeichel, about Mark Hughes, and I was absolutely like borderline obsessed with Mark Hughes as a child. He was born November 1st, I was November 2nd. Back then, every Shoot magazine, every Match magazine, absolutely obsessed with him. You're right, when he went to Chelsea, he said a few things about Chelsea being his boyhood club and stuff that broke my heart. Schmeichel, I've interviewed him, I've talked to him about this, disappointed with his cartwheel too. But in many ways, it shows the complex relationship we have with our heroes.
That's completely it. And again, I felt the same about Hughes. Even the way he looked, he looked like a comic book hero, like the massive thighs and the way he played. It was, and the goals he scored, like people talk about Zlatan now in terms of like his athleticism. Back then, Hughes was doing things that the thing with Zlatan is he's got the kind of body. And he's lithe and he's got the limbs and everything where you can kind of see him doing the extraordinary things and kind of think, well, that makes sense for his body type. Hughes was built like a brick shithouse, and yet... Wait,
ball from Mark Robbins? How long did we talk about Luka Modric doing that? Mark Robbins had that in 1990. The outside, boom, right on the Mark Robbins' head. I mean, unbelievable.
Oh, incredible. So, but what I find really interesting is the fact that There are some sort of feelings you can have about your favorite footballers that you can explain. Like Cantona is an obvious one. There's so many reasons to love Cantona, and it's got to the point now where he's such a legend that I even see staunch Liverpool fans and fans of other clubs saying, like, I hate United, but Cantona's sound, like, and that's testament to sort of how cool he is, how sort of righteous he is in terms of his views and everything. But then you have other players, and it's hard to explain why you feel the way you do about them, good or bad. Like one player that I a couple of players. First of all, I wish we had a player like Van Nistelrooy now. I always think I've always thought of him as an amazing player, and in a lot of ways, in spite of the fact he's so highly rated, I still think he's underrated. But having said that, and again, I've got no problem with him, nothing against him, but I wonder, why isn't he why didn't United fans take him to their hearts more than they did?
Mm-hmm.
It's a strange one. And then you've got a slightly more extreme example of Rio Ferdinand is possibly the best defender Manchester United have ever had. That's an argument that you can make.
Yep.
I I've never felt any affiliation with him. Like, even in his playing days, forget the time he was kind of flirting with Chelsea, even before then. Like, I just never had a connection. And that's nothing really to do with him, but I just find it strange how you can, as a fan, you can have an incredible connection with a player or have zero connection with another player. And it makes no sense. And it's almost that thing of like, even in sort of a romantic relationship, you don't choose who you love. You don't choose who you fall in love with. And it's almost like that with football in a lot of ways. And that's why you get cult heroes. That's why you get the whole point of a cult hero is it's a player that for whatever reason the fans latch onto, and it's not because he's the best player. It's just because there's a strange connection that sort of it's players like why do people to this day still sort of like have this intense sort of memory and sort of fondness for Remy Moses,
mm-hmm.
like. If you look at like in football terms, like in a lot of ways, an underrated player, tenacious and everything, but like he was loved beyond what he should have been in a logical sense, and it's hard to comprehend. And there's other players like Kevin Moran is another player that was loved. I'm trying to think of a modern like people are really fond of Veron,
mm-hmm.
Or even like Karol Pawłowski or Diego Forlan, and it doesn't always make sense, but you just know that you feel that connection to them in some way.
Yeah, I think for me, you know, obviously it depends on your age and where you're at and your perspective in life, but to me, a guy with average ability is much more endearing to me if they are going to give 100%, they're not above themselves, there's still people that have a relationship with the fans that aren't people that are, you know, don't get near me, you know. Some sense I felt more of an endearment towards average players than I did towards Ronaldo, because there's a certain aloofness there where this feels just like a job. And I'm out the first time, you know, it is not expedient to me, then my relationship with him is different. But if you're someone that, you know, gives you 100% every week, that plays like a fan would, that can be endearing to me. But I accept that there's lots of, you know, there's lots of examples that would make me a hypocrite on that. But I don't know the exact answer.
Maybe it's just that sense of people just... I think human beings just instinctively have like a sixth sense about who they should care about and who they shouldn't. And that's why it's really hard to bluff people. That's why it's really hard to sort of over time con people into thinking you're a good person or you care, because sooner or later people can just work you out.
Your accents always speak louder. Anyways, let me ask you about young Zidane Iqbal, because he ends up becoming best for Manchester United. How important for you as a Muslim Asian to see someone that from your background playing for Manchester United?
Oh, it was incredible. And I mean, if I'd have had someone to latch onto like that when I was a kid, it would have meant the world to me. And I see it in my nieces and nephews, like they're now getting ingratiated into football mainly sort of due to sort of me. And it's like they love that. Even though like it perhaps looks as if long term his future was elsewhere, then that's fine. Like, because he's made that mark, and if enough players make that mark and those things tot up, like occasionally, like eventually you will have a player who breaks through. And if there's enough talented players knocking at the door, then one of them will break through and then you'll have a superstar. And I just think it's, to this day, I think it's ridiculous that in such a multicultural country, forget Muslim, like we've not had an Asian superstar in the England team. Like, why not? It's ridiculous. And I sort of go into it in the book, and like there's all sorts of excuses about like, oh, maybe it's the physique, maybe it's this, maybe it's that, maybe it's the strength. You only have to have a look at the amount of boxers, Asian boxers.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, Prince Nassim, or lots of them.
Yeah. So the whole physicality thing is a red herring, and you only have to look at
prejudice even built into that assumption. You hear that out here about young black men. You know, their physique is what allows them to be so successful in American football. This is prejudice at its core. You know, even if people are conscious of it, it's, you know, are you saying that white guy has the perfect physique?
And you're not telling me that Jasper Olsen or Gordon Strachan or Phil Foden or Paul Scholes are like perfect sort of examples of masculine physiques that they could make. It will happen. It will inevitably happen. But it's like that thing about sort of wanting the book to sort of inspire like kids, like Muslim kids in the future to do something like that. As soon as you see it happening, you feel that it can happen for you as well. So I just think as soon as a little bit like I mean, I write about Prince Nassim in the book in terms of like he was actually Yemeni, so Middle Eastern, but in every sense to me, he just felt like a Pakistani kid just like me. So I think his success opened the door for a whole generation of like Asian kids who wanted to take up boxing, and then you saw the success of that, and you see the success of that to this day. So the same will happen to football. Like as soon as you get the first Asian football superstar, like you'll get a whole generation that will come after them, I'm sure.
I think one of the things about Nassim was going back to what we were saying earlier, he became a superstar whilst also making sure that a big part of his identity was that he was a proud Muslim. You know, it wasn't something that he had to suppress. You know, you saw what Muhammad Ali went through, right? He was unashamed about who he was and what, you know, prejudices were leveled at him because he was so good that he was able to tell other Asian kids, if you, whatever level you make it to in life, or Muslim kids, or, you know, Yemeni, or whatever your background is, if your religion does not have to be suppressed. You know, Mike Tyson now is a proud Muslim. You know, I've spent some time in Mike's company, deeply spiritual guy. Devin Haney that fights tomorrow night against Ryan Garcia. Now all of a sudden, you know, this is not something that you need to pretend doesn't exist, so the young kids can be proud and secure in their identity. I think that doesn't matter whether you're, you know, Muslim, Jewish, doesn't matter, right? Because that, to me, is not an important determiner of who you are. It's all about how you treat other people. And I think that brings up a good point. I want to ask you about your dad, because you brought something up there that's very important. You lost your dad when you were 15, is that correct?
A little bit later, I was 18.
18? So yeah. Tell me a bit about that.
Well, I mean, essentially it was a case of he was having like bad health for a while, sort of, and he was like kind of forced to retire. And then, he had a stroke, and then there was bleeding in the head, and he went into, essentially, he was rushed to hospital after a stroke, and then over about a 2-week period, he deteriorated from recognizing us to just being able to squeeze our hands to slowly deteriorating and then passing away. And this feels like a really strange thing to say, and I kind of acknowledged this in the book, that I don't even know if proud is the right word, but one of my proudest kind of moments was in my life is that I was there when he died. Like I was there by his side in the hospital and I saw him breathe his last breath, and then he died, and I feel sort of humbled and sort of proud that I could have been there for him for that moment. And then what that essentially means is, especially because we had no uncles or aunties or cousins or anything or grandparents in this country, I kind of de facto became like the man of the house, if you want to call it that. I mean, I had two older sisters who were incredible. and were so much more emotionally mature than me and sort of dealt with it a lot better than me. But like a lot of the burden sort of was put on my shoulders to sort of deal with things and carry the family forward and look after my siblings and my mum. And again, you talk about things you're most proud of in life. Yeah. And it's not about making money. It's not about I've got this job or I got this promotion. The things that you should be most proud about is what you've done for other people in life. And like I hope that I've always been there for my family and the people I love and my mom and my brothers and sisters and now my nieces and nephews and that's what's important. Like I think for me over time I grew into being that person that people turn to and sort of speak to and ask for help and everything and it's got to a stage now where I'm that's who I am and I'm comfortable to be that. But it was tough sort of like as a teenager suddenly realizing that it's on you. And mm-hmm. if you're struggling at any point in your life, if you're sort of doubting yourself, if you're sort of feeling full of despair, there's no one older than you that you can go to. Yeah. There's no dad that you can say like, mm-hmm. I don't know what I'm doing in this situation. Yeah. Like help me. There's no one like that. But again, like you find the strength in the things that are important to you. And football was really important at that time. Football becomes more important in the tough times because it becomes that release and that escape. And you turn to your friends, you sort of garner strength from your family. And you just do it because you do it because you kind of have to. And obviously for me, a big thing was my religion and my faith. And yeah. Okay. I appreciate for a lot of people, especially if they aren't sort of, they don't have a religion or they don't have a faith. Like I completely appreciate and I respect anyone sort of whether they've got any faith or no faith and just sort of like have got a belief system of just being a good human.
If you find solace, you find comfort, you find inspiration in your faith, you don't know an explanation.
That's it. So from my point of view, and I know for a lot of people like who don't believe in God, they think, well, you just believe in a fairy tale. But
that's just another form of prejudice because nobody knows.
I know.
You look at even the basic principles of quantum mechanics. I mean, we don't. Anesthesiologist doesn't know how anesthetic works because we don't know how you're conscious. You know, we look at when classical physics, the turn of the 20th century, were claiming that we, pretty much discovered everything there is to discover in physics, just a matter of dotting the I's and crossing the T's. This is before quantum physics was even discovered. And then we realized that, you know what? We have no idea what collapses a wave function from superposition into, consensus reality. A snake looks at a wall, sees infrared. You and I look at a wall, see something totally different. The behavior, particles of, conjugate variables. We don't know how to measure, if you want to measure a particle, you can't know its speed, or you can only know its location, or you can only know its speed. And, the speed of light apparently is the fastest thing in the universe. But if we split particles in reverse their spin, they mirror each other exactly the same speed, faster than the speed of light. So that means their quantum entanglement, we're connected forever. I mean, science determinism is working off the same premise. Give me one free miracle and explain the world, because quantum, vacuum energy can explain the Big Bang, but doesn't explain information. And so there's we have to be humble in our understanding. That I think one thing that is really interesting about humanity is even primitive civilizations who weren't in contact with each other all developed a belief in something greater than themselves. And didn't matter where human beings were, they always believed in some, whether it was monotheism or polytheism, it doesn't matter. There was always a belief. And no science. Science was nowhere near even giving you a mathematical equation to explain why we eat chocolate and it doesn't taste like bread. I have no fucking idea, right? So, you know, there's a lot that we have to be humble about ourselves, about our experience in the world, and you know, being claiming it's deterministic and saying that we're just a bunch of organisms. I mean, I don't know what the truth is, to be honest. And I think that the universe is obviously smarter than us, because we're clearly not smarter than the universe and our intelligence and our experience. I mean, if I was born blind and I said, you describe the color green to me, you never could. Because yeah. It's just, those are just symbols. You have to experience something. And I think that matters. And I think you have to be humble about...
I think that's key. I think that word humble is like at the center of so much of what we're talking about, because, and again, like it's that thing of like, I didn't have a dad to turn to and aspect, yeah. but I did have God. Like, mm-hmm. like I could 5 times a day, I could pray and I could speak, yeah. to God and I could help me through this. Like, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how I'm going to cope with this, but help me deal with this. And that gave me solace. And This seems like such a sort of daft pop culture reference, but it's almost like Dumbo and the feather. Like, mm-hmm. if that's the thing that made him believe that he could fly, that had worth.
And it's, absolutely.
And it's that thing of like, I think it's always healthy in life to realize that this thing's bigger than you, and whether that's God. Whether that's, yes. another form of spirituality, whether that's just society, whether that's believing that you are part of society and that's fundamental to who you are, and it's not just, life is not just individualistic and sort of, it's not a competition of like, I've got to win and you've got to lose.
No.
If you can feel part of something bigger than you are, even something like football, if you can believe that you are a small part of something bigger, not only does that make you feel as if you belong in some fundamental way, but like you say, it gives you a sense of humility. It gives you a sense of, I am not the center of the world. I'm part of the world.
Mate, this is exactly how I feel and why I don't like prejudice at all. I think that the apple isn't played in the seed. And you've just little seed, and that we are as much a part of the universe as the sun and the stars. And you take a cup of water out of the ocean, you take a little drop, the whole ocean is in that little drop of water. And I think that's what we all are. We're all a massive part of the universe, and that we are all supposed to be here. Last question, when you're grieving for your dad, do you grieve what you lost, or do you grieve what you didn't get to experience?
I mean, over time, you try and be philosophical about it. The way I look at it is I didn't get to have that time with him that I wish I had, because I think it's a special time.
Sorry, mate, go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think it's a special time when you are an adult as well as your,
yes.
parents, because you can speak to them on a level that you couldn't as a child.
Yes.
And obviously I didn't have that with my dad, because just as I was on the cusp of reaching that level, I lost him. But then I kind of think, well, I had him for as long as I needed him, and I'm so grateful that I had him for that amount of time. And what it does do is, not only does it make you grateful for what you had, but it makes you determined to make your existence worthwhile for other people. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and I find it, and again, like, you look for positives in the world. I find it amazing how many, some of the most amazing people that I have ever met have gone through immeasurable hardship, mm-hmm. and some of the best fathers and best mothers and best parents that I've ever met were not treated nicely by their own. And I think you can learn good things, and you can learn from good things, and you can learn from bad things, but it's that thing. It's a stereotype, but it's true. Of like, the most interesting people that I've ever met are the people who have struggled most with the mental health, or gone through difficulties or faced addiction or faced sort of tragic circumstances, because those are the people who have experienced those situations and got through it and learned something from it and have been shaped by it. And that's why even hardship, as difficult as it can seem, it's can sometimes be its own kind of blessing, and it can not only can it make you a stronger person and make you a better person and make you a more humanitarian in terms of your outlook, but it can also affect other people because you learn not to be what you don't want to be, and you're kinder and nicer to the next generation or the next people you meet.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. When you have an intimate relationship with suffering, you never want to be ignorant to someone else's, or in order to be the cause of it. You are your father's legacy. You have, every day you do him proud. You're someone that I am really glad I've got to know. You're someone that I've had tremendous respect and admiration for years, for your humor, for your sensitivity, for your your growth as a person that I've seen over years, because we've known each other a long time. Contribution you make to the Native community, the contribution to you make to people who have a similar background to you, who need voices like yourself to help the next generation coming up, so that they can do the same, so that this can get normalized, and so that they feel that they're included and there's people exactly like them are also a voice to them. And there's very few people that are more eloquent and better placed to speak than yourself. I highly recommend, folks, you get this book. It's a brilliant read. And if you're someone of our generation that grew up watching United, you will be taken on a walk down memory lane. If you're not, read it and know what it was like to be there. Fantastic experience, brilliant book. I will post links to it for you to download. And mate, I would love to get you back. Absolutely fantastic. Thank you for having me. So thank you for coming on.
Oh, thank you so much. And like I said, it's the first real conversation we've had, but like it feels like talking to an old friend. And yeah, like everything that you've said, like it's the same for me. Like I really appreciate sort of even up to the current day, you will share sentiments about what's happening in the world, and quite often it'll be unpopular sentiments that you know will get you heat, but like you stand by your principles and you're shaped by what's happening in your life and the difficulties you faced in your life in such a beautiful, positive way. And it's all reciprocated.
I'm not a clumsy order. Sometimes we say things that I probably could be better at, but my ultimate sentiment is I just want to live in a world that doesn't use a flim as a pretext to slaughter each other. Because, something that I was reading in your book that is pertinent to this was when you were walking through cemeteries reading different headstones of people that lived short lives, long lives. The fact is someone loved them. To put that there, and the grief and suffering that we impose on each other due to some sense of superiority and legitimacy is a major mistake. And none of us are free until all of us are free, and we have equitable respect for each other and love for each other. And I think that is achievable. I think one of the reasons why we don't achieve it is because powerful people have incentives not to achieve it, and they use it as a tool of division. And I look at my own community, where Catholic and Protestant once seemed impossible to grow together, and to learn that we have so much in common that and all those divisions are being eroded now because the incentive to keep them is disappearing. And I don't want to live in a world that justifies your death or the death of your children on some ridiculous sense of righteousness, or mine, or anyone's for that matter. It's just insane, but... Yeah. That's all it is. You're quite right that some of the bravest people that have spoken up against this, or people who would benefit from not speaking up about it, and Jewish people who've been incredibly brave in finding their voice. Say, this is not my name, I'm not defined by this, in exactly the same way that governments use their people and make them culpable for their crimes. This is not people, this is governments. Mate, thank you so much for everything. I appreciate it. I know it's Friday night, Friday afternoon for me. So I will let you get back to your evening, have a brilliant weekend. Hopefully you need to get a win on Sunday.
Brilliant, you too.
Hey, see you later, mate. Bye.